My name is Earl Williams, and I'm an alcoholic. And first off, I'd like to, I was going to thank Milton for having me here tonight. Thanks, Milton. Wherever you are. I'm real proud and happy to have been asked here and to be a part of this roundup this weekend. I've never been here before, and I've heard a lot about it. My sponsor's been up here several times and spoken to you people, and I've heard nothing but good things about it. I know a lot of people that are here tonight, and I have some very good friends that have come up here tonight. I'm real happy for that, because if I forgot something, they could holler out buzzwords at me, just in case, you know. Jail or what have you. Whatever comes up right there. Some of these people have heard my story a couple of times. In any case, I know this is going to be a really nice weekend. I've enjoyed it so far. The first thing I noticed when I came here was that there's no television in the rooms. It's not that I'm an addict or anything. I just realized that there was nothing in that television corner. I started to send out for one, but I started to call my friend Jerry and warn him, you know. I knew they'd miss it. Not for myself, of course. We've got some really neat people lined up this weekend to speak, and I'm looking forward to the thing. I've heard Bill several times and always enjoyed him. I've not heard Martha before, but I'm looking forward to it. I've known her, I've seen her around, and I've seen Gail around, and I'm looking forward to that. I've been part of that story. She's never seen me drink, which is why she's still married to me. My other wives that have seen me drink are not married to me anymore. I'd like to go on record right off the bat of saying that that's not really my fault. Not my fault. I started drinking. I first enjoyed alcohol when I was about 11 years old. And that's not to say, you know, there are people now that we have people in meetings now that have been daily drinkers since they were 6 or 8 or something like that. We go to a meeting on Monday night that are full of real young people that have just been drinking, I guess, since day one almost, you know. I first got drunk when I was about 11. I'd had some alcohol before that, and I always liked the taste of it. I have several alcoholics in my family, some admitted, some not. But I had an uncle. My father had been killed in the war, and his family lived in Jackson, Mississippi, and I used to spend my summers down there in Jackson. I had an uncle that was married to my father's sister there, and I used to go down and spend my summers with my grandmother. And this uncle, who incidentally was a grown man, he was 30, 31 years old when I was 11 or 12, he and I were buddies. We were friends. We ran around together when I'd go down there. Sounds really strange, but our minds just sort of interacted together, you know. And I know why now, you know. I know why the man was a drunk. He was an alcoholic. And whether or not I was before I took a drink is a sort of a moot point. We just blended, our personalities blended together. We enjoyed each other. He looked forward to me coming down there, and I looked forward to being with him. He was an architect, and he was a very successful architect in Jackson, Mississippi. He was a musician. He'd studied at Juilliard School of Music, and he'd played in some big bands during the late 30s and early 40s, and he was a drunk. Those three things, and not necessarily in that order. And when I'd go down there, this first time this happened, I knew he drank a little bit, and at the time this happened, he wasn't really, I don't know if he was a full-blown alky or not. I'd never seen him do anything particularly bad or wild or different or anything. I knew he drank a little. But one night, we went out, at me at 11, and he came by my grandmother's house and picked me up, and we slipped off, and first thing we did was go across the Pearl River Bridge down there. And of course, Mississippi was dry at that time. This would have been in the middle 50s. And we went across the Pearl River Bridge down there and pulled up behind a 7-Eleven, what looked like a 7-Eleven, and the guy brought it right out to the car, no problem, you know. It was a lot easier to get it than having to get out and go in and get it. And he bought a fifth of vodka. And on the way back across the bridge, He handed it to me and asked me if I'd take the top off, and I did. And he asked if I wanted a little sip of it. And, of course, I did. I did because I knew he was going to drink a little bit. And I thought this was going to be wonderful, being out with, same as Chet, being out with Chet and just having a great time. And I took a big pop out of that bottle and handed it to him, and he did, and then I did. And just before you knew it, I was on the moon. I was on the moon. I had my first religious experience. It was the wildest thing I have ever lived through. I loved it. I loved it. I had been, from the time I was born, I had been an introvert. I was fearful, and I had that feeling of being on the outside. I always felt like I never fit in. I never belonged. I never knew what everybody else knew. It was hard for me to talk in groups of people. I was thinking today, I used to go to, even when I was real, real young, I used to go to like birthday parties at my cousin's house, and there was nobody there except people I knew real well, and I still always felt like I was an outsider. I always felt like an outsider. I felt like that when I was in school. I can look back now and see that it's a whole lot of what I felt was what I'd call now loneliness. I felt real lonely, not a part of. But I didn't realize at that time, of course, I wouldn't have used that word. I wouldn't have known. I didn't know what it was. Certainly didn't know it was loneliness. But I grew up like that. And when I was in school, I can remember even at a real young age, but mainly I think about when I was in junior high school and high school, and I'd be in the halls and a group of people would walk by and they'd be laughing, and I'd think they were laughing at me. Well, I'd know they were laughing at me, you know. I'd know they were, and I'd see people over in the corner talking or standing by a doorway talking, and I'd know as I went by they were talking about me. That I was just self-absorbed and self-centered, but I was still afraid. Everything revolved around me and related to me, and it was no good. And so that night when I was out with Chet, and I took those few little sips of vodka, and I tell you, it just opened up a whole new world for me. It was magic. It was magic. It was magic to me. And from then on, that's what I wanted to do. And I know the next day I got back to my grandmother's house, and I remember calling him up and saying, when are we going to do this again, you know, and I just couldn't wait to get back out again. And that's the way it went in the summer times. I couldn't do that in the winter time, and I had a hard time in school. I had a hard time getting through school because I wasn't shy exactly. I wasn't what you'd call shy, but I was an introvert. And I just didn't seem to fit, didn't belong. So in my summers, I'd go down there, and I'd write him all during the year, and I just couldn't wait. We had built, my family had built what we called a hunting lodge down in mid-south Mississippi, down in Capaya County. And I'm not sure why we called it a hunting lodge. Nobody ever really hunted down there that I knew of. I accidentally shot a squirrel down there one time. It made me so sad I didn't know what to do. I was never able to do that again. I was always real sensitive. But we'd go hunting down there. This is what we'd tell my aunt and my grandmother, that we were going to go hunting. And even it would be in the middle of summer. They didn't know when you hunted, you know. And we'd get our hunting coats. It'd be 100 degrees out there. We'd get these hunting jackets and we took rifles to hunt with, you know. And we'd go down. We would say, well, we're going down to the place. That's what we call it. We're going down to the place, spend the weekend, hunt squirrel, and blah, 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 blah. And that's the way they'd let us go. My uncle was real henpecked. But that's the way we'd get out, and that's the way we'd go. And he'd stop somewhere and pick up a couple of six-packs of beer, and he'd always had a couple of bottles of vodka, and we'd take off. And sometimes we went down to the place, and sometimes we didn't. As the biggest part of town, we never got there. The biggest part of town, what we usually did was go down to Natchez. Sometimes we went to New Orleans, but ordinarily we'd go to Natchez because it was closer. And Natchez, although still dry at that time, was a real wild place. My uncle liked to gamble a little bit, and he knew of some joints down there that he could get to and gamble. And we'd go to one, it'd be like a beer joint or something, and usually real nice. We'd go in, and he'd put me on a bar stool, and they'd serve me beer all night, and he'd go back and gamble or do whatever he did. He said he was gambling. I don't know what he was doing in the back room. There's no telling, really. But they'd serve me beer, and there I'd sit, you know. And I know you won't believe this, but I was real little in those days. And I'd sit up. I've grown a lot in the program. I was real little in those days. I'd sit at this bar, and I must have looked like I was 8 or 9 years old. You know, I was probably 12, 13, 14 at this time. And the bartender would bring me beer, and I'd sit there, and I'd look in the mirror, and what I would see and what I was were two entirely different things, you know. I'd look in the mirror and I'd have this beard, and I imagined myself as I could see a movie star or something sitting there. You know, that's what I felt like. I felt like I used to think I looked like William Powell. You ever see the Thin Man movies, and William Powell walked through these Thin Man movies? He always had a martini, and he was always wearing a tuxedo, and he always looked so suave and sophisticated. And when I'd look in the mirror, and I'd be drinking that beer, and that's what I'd see. That's the way I imagined myself. And I could talk to people. I could talk to the bartender or whoever came in there. I loved it. I loved it. And then we'd have to go back to my grandmother's house, and then I'd have to turn into a little kid again, and I'd have to go back home again. And I was miserable when I was at home. And it wasn't because of my family. I had a wonderful family, you know. I can't say anything bad about them. It was all an inside job with me, an inside job. By the time I was 16, I'd found out how to get whiskey in Memphis. And in those years, it wasn't as easy, you know, for a kid as it is now. A kid can do anything, get a drink, get anything they want, I guess. I don't think we even knew about anything else in those days. If they did, it was almost myth. You know, do you really believe there's any such thing as marijuana? I don't know. I never seen any, you know. So we didn't really know about that stuff. But we did know about alcohol. I had one friend at that time. I think most of my life I had at least one friend, and that's really about all I usually had. And he was usually a misfit, just like I was. And by the time I was in the 12th grade, that's what I had, a sort of a misfit friend. And he drank like I did. We ran around together, and mostly what we wanted to do was just drink. I found out that we could get a bottle on the weekends, and really by the time I was in the 12th grade, I was drinking most every night, one way or another, and having little hangovers in the morning or something. Right after school, I got through school that way. And really, you'd think it would have been hard, but it was looking back on it, it was a whole lot easier for me to go to school and for me to blend in with people, with that to look forward to in life. I was a mess. I was a mess in those days. When I got out of school, I got married right away, and I married a little girl who was 16. I was 18. We'd fallen madly in love, you know. I was real obsessed about that also. I was a real obsessive person. I used to lay in bed at night and look at her picture on the wall and cry. I was afraid I wasn't going to get her, you know. I was afraid it was going to disappear and go away, you know. I couldn't stand it. I had to have that, and so I did. We got married. I know. Some of her family knew that I had drank a good bit, and one of her sisters had told her not to marry me. She told me one night. She said, "My sister told me not to mess around with you, not to date you, not to marry you, because you were an alcoholic." And I went into my head and I just laughed. You know, I just talked her out of it. And I said, "An alcoholic? I'm 17 years old. How can I be an alcoholic? Ha 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 ha!" But you know, we had some alcoholics in our family. And as far as I knew, I might have been one. I didn't doubt it. I didn't doubt it in my mind. I'd even thought of it. I'd even thought of that. I'd even thought of that as a possibility, because what I saw in the alcoholics in my family, who were a couple of uncles and so forth, I saw that they would begin to drink, and either they didn't want to stop or they weren't able to stop very easily. They'd usually turn into real asses when they did that, you know. The personalities would change somehow, and at least a couple of them. And I could see that in me. I could see those things in me. Now, I had no idea about all the other things that went with alcoholism. With me, it was just a matter of, it had something to do with drinking, and that's what I did. And I knew once I started drinking, it was hard for me to quit. I knew I enjoyed it, and I knew other things too, but there it was. So I talked her out of it, and we got married, had a couple of kids right off the bat. And I went out to Memphis State for a short time, and quit that because I knew I was not going to be able to concentrate on it long enough to graduate. I couldn't concentrate on anything for any length of time. I had to look around for something that was going to be fast, something that I could learn fast and get out and get to work and go with it. And so I went to beauty school. I went down and visited the thing one day, and it looked like it was going to be a lot of fun, and that's the way I judged everything anyway. Was it going to be fun? Was it going to be quick? Was it going to be easy? And it seemed to be those things, and so I became a hairdresser. And I drank all during beauty school. I just barely got out of it. It took 9 months. I'd like to never made that. By the end of it, I was having to go out in between people, and I'd go out and just lay down in somebody's car. I'd be drunk. I kept a little bottle of, a little squeeze bottle. You know those little squeeze bottles like to put color on with? I kept a little squeeze bottle of... I kept a little squeeze bottle of vodka under my station. And, you know, I'd drink a little bit of it every once in a while. And, you know, you can imagine what happened. A friend of mine came back to the break room one day and asked me what in the world was in that squeeze bottle. I told him it was vodka. And he said, "Oh, no, I just used it on so-and-so's hair out there." It didn't bother me so much that he'd done that. It was just a waste of good vodka, I thought. But I just barely got out of that school, and I went to work for a man out in who had several shops, and I had been an admirer of he and his shops. He had the best places in town, and I had already decided I wasn't going to go to work unless I could go to work for him. And in fact, he wouldn't hire me at first. I didn't go to work for several months, till he called me up one day and asked me if I would, and I did. I went to work for one of his shops out by Elvis's house, and I worked out there for about 13 years, and I did real well. I found out that a hairdresser can drink and get everything done. It just works out real well. It's not much of a job, frankly. I never really considered it actually work. I enjoyed it, and it was easy and simple, you know, and I could go to work with the worst hangover imaginable, and all I had to do was just sort of get through it. As time went on, of course, by the time I went to work there, everything was new. I was feeling new. I was excited about this job and so forth, and I was only drinking on the weekends. I wasn't drinking a whole lot on the weekends when I first started, but it built up. It built up, and as my drinking progressed over a number of years, my weekends got longer and fatter and wider, and my weekdays got squashed up like this. And where I had been drinking maybe Saturday night and Sunday, eventually I was drinking Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then Thursday through Monday, and then, you know, Wednesday through Wednesday. And what I would do, I'd go to work later, and I'd take off earlier, and I'd just do the same amount of people, and just squeeze them up in the middle of the day, work as fast as I could, and get out. Go to the bar. And it worked real well for a long time. And you know, my wife, we had a couple of kids. We had two daughters. And my wife never said a whole lot about that, really. It didn't seem to be causing any particular problems for a time. As it turns out, she was affected by it, or said she was sometime later, you know. Maybe I could see that she was, I don't know. But of course, I got worse. As I drank, I got worse, which is what always happens when there's an alcoholic in the family, if he's like me. And as I drank more, and as I had personality changes, and I'd begin to get angry, and I begin to get resentful of things, and I begin to get everything else that alcoholics get. Not sure exactly how that happens, but that's what happened to me. And it got worse and worse in that house. I just did one time in jail, and it was in 1968, I think. My daughter thinks it wasn't, but I think that's about when it was, 1968. And I'd been out drunk for some time with some friends of mine. And we'd been downtown on this particular Sunday evening, and it was time for them to go home. And I had two friends, I think, at that time. And I dropped them off, and I wasn't ready to quit drinking yet. And I went back downtown and drank a little more and drank a little more. And on the way back, I had to go all the way out of Memphis and all the way down south, down around Elvis's house there, and to where I lived. And I lived just on the other side of, if you all have been there, I don't know. I lived just on the other side of his house. And it was raining, and it was cold, it was November, and it was a rotten night, and I was drunk, and been drunk for several days. I was in a crappy mood anyway, and I was on the way past, just about the time I passed that Graceland down there. I had my window rolled down, let a little water come in to try to keep me awake so I could drive, and just one eye on the road, just like we do. You know, I just kind of aimed the car, hoped it got there the best way it could. And as I was going south, the squad car passed me going north, and I never should have looked. I never looked again, but this particular time I looked. I looked at him as he went by like this, and he looked at me as he went by like this. we had that magical meeting of the minds, you know, and it was some sort of cop instinct, I guess, and he knew I was drunk. I guess he knew I was drunk, and I knew he knew I was drunk. That was worse. And I just had a little ways to go, not far from here to the end of the church. I was going to turn left, and I was thinking, this guy's going to follow me. And I looked in my rearview mirror, and sure enough, he whipped around the middle of the street, and I turned left down my street. And I remember I felt like I was driving real slow, and maybe I wasn't, I don't know, as it turned out. But I felt like I was driving real slow, and I was watching the rearview mirror, and I was watching this policeman turn the corner back there, and I was thinking, this guy's going to follow me right up into my driveway. My driveway was right at the end of the street. Go at the end of the street, right into my driveway, and everything's going to be okay. And I was going to jump out and give him the laws about private property. you know, my drunken mind. Here I am on private property, and just who do you think you are pulling up here and blah, blah, blah. I was really going to let him have it. And just about that time, I hit the parked car and on the wrong side of the street, and I told him it was not a good scene. Bad scene. And I tore up my car, and I tore up the car that I hit. And the policeman pulled up behind me there, and I was halfway in the car and halfway out of the car. And right down at the end of the street there, my little house, just maybe two doors down. I had taken my best friend home just shortly before that. He was one of the guys that I'd dropped off, and he was upstairs. He couldn't come down there because he was drunk. But he told me later that his wife, they woke up, they heard this noise. His wife woke up, and in fact, she was the first person that told me that. She told me one time, she was a real dry person. She's the first person that ever told me that my main problem was that I suffered from visions of adequacy. But in any case, this particular night, the crash woke her up, and Charles said she just sat up in bed and said, "Well, Earl's home." And sure enough, she went down and got my wife, and they came down to this crash scene, and I don't remember much of it. I remember blue lights, and they evidently tied me up or something. And when I woke up, I was in the Baptist hospital, and I was chained to a bed, and one of my customers was standing behind me taking blood out of my arm, and I was thinking, this is wonderful. I am going to get out of this. This woman's taking blood out of my arm. She's going to destroy the evidence. I'm going to get right out of this. My wife is standing over here, and my best friend's wife. There are always wives around when these things happen, you know. And here they stand, and I'm thinking, this is going to be wonderful. Of course, I'm chained to bed. And they took me to jail, and at first, I didn't mind, really. I didn't mind. You know, when you're drunk, you don't mind jail. You don't mind anything. When I was drunk, I could do anything. When I was drunk, I could go anywhere. I could be anybody. I could handle any situation. I could take care of anything. I could be Superman. I could be Clark Gable. I could be anything I wanted to be. And so I was not afraid when these two policemen carried me into the station house like this. And I knew that I looked sharp. I always looked sharp when I was drinking. I knew I looked sharp. I had this old white sweater. I had this old white sweater flung across my shoulder like this. I was imagining Frank Sinatra in my mind, you know, when he used to walk through those spotlights. And here I go walking into this station house, and of course I'd thrown up on myself, but I was sure that they didn't really notice that part of it, you know, and when I knew I looked so cool. So I went walking into the station. I had blood all over me, and I was banged up in the ribs and everything, but still cool, and I snatched away from them, and I walked up to this desk sergeant, and I threw that old white sweater over the desk, and I said, "I wonder if you'd mind watching this for me while I'm in here. I won't be here long." And well, he didn't react very nicely to that. None of them reacted very nicely much after that. They took me back and put me in a cell. And they didn't put me in a tank. They just put me in a cell. And I was real grateful for that later on. There was a guy in there who was in there for petty larceny. And it was his third or fourth time, and he was getting ready to go to somewhere up in Tennessee, and he was looking forward to it, and he kept telling me how great it was, you know. I thought, this man is really loony. And I was still drunk. I was still feeling great. I remember I beat on the bars and called for an aspirin, and, you know, they didn't give it to me. They came back and acted real nasty towards me. So I stayed in there all night, and as the night wore on, and I started getting a little soberer, the stuff started wearing off, and I started getting a little soberer, and I started getting a little afraid. Because they started bringing some more guys in there, and the more guys they were bringing in there were big guys. And as the night went on, the guys got bigger and scarier, and I got littler and more afraid. And I was handing out cigarettes. I remember I was handing out cigarettes just as fast as I could. I was trying to make instant friends, you know. "Yeah, have a cigarette, brother. Have a cigarette." I gave somebody my old white sweater. "You look cold. Here, wrap up." But I got out the next day, and I had called. I had my one phone call, and called my wife, and she'd called my boss, Mr. Gould, on Gould's there in town, and she'd called him, and he'd called a lawyer. And as I went before this judge, I looked back in the back of the room, and there was my boss, and there was the lawyer, and there was my mother, there was my wife, there was my little brother, and they'd all come to get me out of jail, like it was an adventure or something, you know. So they bound me over to the grand jury, and this lawyer somehow got my license back. And here I'd just spent a night in jail. I'd been bound over to the grand jury on DWI charge. I was a mess. My ribs were all banged up. I had a little dried blood all over me. And I'd totaled my car. I'd totaled the car that I'd run into. I was in terrible trouble. And my mother said, "Here, maybe you'd better drive." people don't understand this thing. They don't ever understand this thing, do they? She gave me those car keys, and I drove home. And on the way home, I told them, I said, I had done a little thinking about it in jail, and I had decided to quit drinking. This was in 1968. And I remember thinking, I have gotten in trouble here. I've gotten in trouble, bad trouble, and I'm going to quit drinking. And I told them on the way home, I said, I'm just not going to do that anymore. And I didn't. I quit drinking right there in 1968, sometime in November. It didn't last very long, but I quit. And I got home, I called my two friends on the phone, and I told them I was going to quit drinking. I told them what had happened, you know. I told them I was going to quit drinking. They said, "Oh, that's fine." You know, they went along with anything. "Well, that's wonderful that you're going to quit drinking." And I did. I didn't have to go to work that day, and I sort of got everything worked out. They were going to get me a new car, insurance was, you know, and I knew everything was going to be okay. I figured I was going to get out of it. You know, what the hell, I'd always gotten out of everything I'd been in. And so I made it until about Thursday. That was Monday, and I made it till Thursday. And I was sitting at home Thursday night, and I felt great. A lot of times when I'd quit drinking, I'd feel great right afterwards, you know. I'd feel wonderful. I'd quit. I'd say, "I have quit. This is wonderful." And I remembered when I was 18, 19 years old, I thought I was nuts. I thought I was crazy. I thought I was crazy because I felt so different than everybody else looked like they felt. We've all heard that before, you know, and that's the way I judged myself anyway. And I just felt so different and so unusual and so outside and just all those things. And I remembered thinking, if I could just get to a shrink, if I could somehow get to some doctor and tell him this story, maybe he could help me out. Maybe he could work on me. Maybe he could fix me. And I never was able to do that. But I remembered also thinking, if I could just have this wife that I'm going to have, you know, and if we could have a couple of kids, a couple of nice kids, and maybe a nice place to live, and a nice little bit of furniture, and maybe a nice car, and if I could just make about $100 a week, if I had a job and just make about $100 a week, I believe I'd be okay. I believe I wouldn't feel so screwed up and skewed. I'd just be wonderful. And there I'm sitting there this Thursday night, and I've quit drinking. My life's going to turn around, and I'm thinking, "Oh gosh, I've got all those things. I remembered that. I've got all those things. I've got a nice job. I was making about $100 a week. I was going to get a new car. I thought about that. I was going to get a new car. Everything was great. My wife was in there. I had two kids. It was really grand." And I remember thinking, you know, this is wonderful. And a fella in this position, I ought to be able to drink a beer. I ought to be able to drink a beer. Why not? You know, it'd be the perfect end to a perfect evening. And so I went down to the 7-Eleven, bought a six-pack. You know, only time we drink one beer is when we're in transit, you know, going from this 7-Eleven, this 7-Eleven, this 7-Eleven, and so forth. And so that's what I did, and by that weekend, I was drunk again. And that's the first time I knew I was going to have a hard time quitting drinking. That was in 68. I left that family in 73, and by that time, I was really a mess. I had drunk and drunk and drunk, and I'd gotten to be just a daily drinker, and I was really in a hell of a mess. And I know I blamed it on her for a long time that I had to leave that house. I used to say, she squeezed me out of my happy home. She just squeezed me right out of there, you know, away from my loving children and who needed me and all that stuff. If she could have got rid of me about 5 years before, they'd all been in a lot better shape. And, the things that happened in my house are the things that happened in the alcoholic homes. You know, I can remember waking up in the morning and having these visions in my head and thinking, "Oh God, I hope that didn't happen. I hope that wasn't me that did that. You know, I can't believe that. I can't believe that happened to me." And I remember one morning I woke up and the sun was shining and I felt great. I woke up, didn't have a hangover, just felt wonderful. And I looked around, there wasn't anybody there. No wife, no kids. And I remember I got up and I just felt great, went and fixed a cup of coffee and I called around looking for her, you know, and I finally found my wife over at this friend's house. And I said, "Hey, what's going on? Where are you?" And she said, "Don't you remember?" I thought, "Oh God, no." She used to say those things, you know, that's the way we used to get it. The way I used to get it, "Don't you remember?" And then these pictures would come fading in of some crap that I'd pulled last night, some terrible something, some Christmas that I'd screwed up again, or some who knows what. Awful things. And so I had to move out of there. And I did. And that was the worst time of my drinking. That was the worst my actual drinking ever got. And it was in 1973, and I moved into a little house out in, still out close in the neighborhood. And what it was, I had this customer who had they had an estate, a big estate out in Whitehaven. And on this estate, they had a little small wooden house that they kept tools in. they kept a tractor parked under what looked like a little carport. That's where I moved into. And before I moved in there, now I went to Sears and charged a TV. We got to have a TV, you know. I went and got me a TV, and I had an old beanbag chair, an old brown beanbag chair. And I moved into this little house with the tools and all this stuff, and I lived in there, and I used to lay around on this old brown beanbag chair, and the family was gone, and the friends were gone, and I'd watch this television and cry, and I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe that a person with my potential could have wound up like that. You know, my grandmother always said, "You have such potential." Everybody thought I had potential, you know, and I never was sure exactly what that was, but I knew I had it. You know, I knew I had had it. I knew I was wasting whatever it was. And I'd lay around in there and just, it was awful. It was awful. I was in terrible shape. And the floor was just bare concrete, you know. I lay in there, old bare concrete floor. I had an iron bed. They had an iron bed. It was theirs. And it would get wet. This floor would get wet in there. It would flood. This place would flood sometimes. And I remember one morning I got out of bed and I stepped down. There was water all over my apartment. I called it an apartment. There was water all... There was water all over everywhere, you know, and I stepped down and I said, "God almighty, where did this come from?" But I was drunk, and I had to go to work. I didn't really have time to fool with that water. I just got dressed and left. I gave it no more thought, really. I came home that afternoon, and somehow the people had come down, cleaned. I guess they knew what was going on. They came down, cleaned it up, and I went back in there and tried to play like it never happened, and it happened again, again, again. It would rain, and I'd get up, and here would be this water. Well, one night, it was raining real hard, and I was drunk again, and whining and crying and what have you. And I looked outside and I saw the rain. It was coming. It was starting to puddle up in the carport there. And I said, "Well, my God, that's where it comes from." It puddles up around this house. There was no foundation. It was just built right down the ground, you know. And I looked over here under this wall, and the walls were sort of separated from the floor a little bit, you know. And I looked over there, and here came this little puddle, little bitty puddle about this wide under that wall, just floating right under that wall right there. I said, "Well, that's what happens. That's where the water comes in." I went and got a wash rag, squashed it up like this, and stuffed it into that little hole there, and I've nipped this in the bud. That's it. And I looked down here, and here's another little puddle coming. I went and got a towel, and I drew it up and stuck it under that wall. And I said, I have whipped this. That's it. Well, there was a drainage ditch right behind my house. Ran all the way through Whitehaven, and unbeknownst to me, it was slowly filling up. And that's what happened. When it rained, the thing would stop up, it would fill up, and when it got full, it would run over. And as I was standing there watching this little puddle, the thing ran over, and it ran through my house. And it came under the walls, and it came up through the floor, and it looked like little geysers coming up between cracks in the concrete floor. It was just squirting up everywhere. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that was happening. It was just getting deeper and deeper and deeper up the wall. Eventually, there was a watermark about a foot deep on that wall. And I was standing there in the living room. I was watching this water coming in. I was just crying. I didn't know what to do. Didn't know what to do. I left. I just left. And the next day, I went back, and it had gone down a little bit more, you know. And I went, naturally, by this time, you know, I'd been separated for some time, and I had a girlfriend. You know, no matter how bad it gets, you can always get a girlfriend. Isn't that weird? She was about 10 years younger than me, and real dumb. She thought that I was still having fun, you know. She didn't know all this. I'd laugh sometimes, but you know, she didn't know I was. She couldn't see me on the inside. Her inside, she was having a ball. My inside, I was laughing, but on the inside, I was dying. And I called her up, and I was whining, moaning, and God almighty, this mess, this horrible thing that I'm living in. There was muck and grime all over the floor from that flood, you know? And I was, "Joan, it did it again last night." I said, "It just rained in, and I saw it. It came in, it flooded. The whole place was flooding. It was terrible." I said, "It's doing this all the time." I said, "What can I do? What in the world am I going to do?" And this young kid in the wisdom of youth said, "Why don't you move?" I said, by God, that's right. Why don't I move? And I knew right then I had to have her. And somehow or other, I talked her into getting married, you know. Got a good, quick divorce. We got married. We were going to get married. And I remember we got married in church. My mother was there, and my brother and my daughters were there, and, you know, and all these people. And I remember my little brother was there. He was going to stand up with me that day. And I went back in the back of the church. We were talking before the ceremony, you know, and I said, you know, Kenny, I said, from this day forward and forevermore, I'm not ever going to have to make another decision as long as I live. Joan's going to take care of me. It was in about 6 weeks, I knew I'd made a horrible mistake. She was making all the decisions, and I couldn't stand it. I wanted her to do what I wanted her to do, you know. I wanted her to take care of those decisions like that, and I was under her wing. By then, I couldn't get out. I knew I couldn't get out. I knew I was stuck forever. Because in those days, my mind was messed up. And I believed that wherever I was, that's where I was going to be always. If I was in misery, I knew I was going to be in that misery always. If I was in good times, and I hardly ever was in those days, I thought that was going to last forever. But anyway, I knew I couldn't move. I knew I was doomed. Well, what she decided we ought to do, naturally it was all her fault, she decided we needed to go into business for ourselves. And this is the worst of my drinking. This is the worst of my drinking. But I said, okay, what was I going to do after all? So that's what we did. We opened a beauty shop. And her father put up, he had trucks. Her father put up his trucks as collateral, and I still believe today that if you're going to get married, you need to marry somebody with collateral. Family has collateral. And so so we bought this little beauty shop, and I'm going to try to quit drinking now, in earnest. I'm going to try to quit drinking. This is 1975. For 2 years, really, I've been sort of trying to quit. You know, I'm sort of trying to quit. We've gotten married, and life's rolling on a little bit, and we're going to open this business. And what happened was, I didn't drink while we were putting this shop in, because I was in there. I'd go in there every night, and I'd hammer stuff, you know, and I'd nail stuff on the wall, and I put up all these mirror squares in the back, and I built things, and I'd never done stuff like that before, you know, and it was wonderful. It was wonderful. It was my new life. I was starting into our new life. It was going to be my new life and a new beginning, you know, for me. And I was going to turn everything around, and everything was going to be wonderful. And boy, I took about 30 days to get that place open, and all my customers came over. I had a big clientele. All my customers came over there, and I paid for it about 6 weeks. It was great. The money was rolling in, but after about three weeks, I was back in that business. It was the same old people coming in I'd been seeing all that time, and the same old hairdos and same old mess. You know, I started getting just a little bit antsy, just a little bit discontent, a little bit restless, maybe a little bit irritable. And so I had a drink, because that seemed to be the normal thing to do under those circumstances. And then I was drunk again, and I didn't know why I was drunk again. I couldn't figure that out exactly. I had all those feelings, all those crappy feelings all my life, and I had all that restlessness and irritableness and discontentment always. I had always had that, but I couldn't figure out what that had to do with the drinking. I didn't know that it all went hand in hand. I didn't know it was all part of the same thing. I didn't know that for a long time. And so I just figured this was my craziness on this hand, and this drinking. I could drink, and I'd feel better when I drank. And I got drunk again. Drinking didn't work like it used to work. Now, the first drink always worked. The first drink always felt better. Second or third drink, I always felt like $1 million, but then I'd go on with it. I always overdrank a little bit. And that's what I was doing then, see? I found out that there are a lot of things that would keep me sober. There are a lot of things that would keep me sober for periods of time, and I guarantee they'll keep anybody sober for periods of time. They always worked for me. One of them was golf. And you know, when I'd get into anything, I'd get into it obsessively. I'd be obsessive about it. And I got into golf, and I didn't drink. I didn't drink because I was going to be a pro. I was going on the pro tour. The fact that I was 30 years old and about this big didn't seem to make any difference, you know. I knew that was going to happen for me. Boy, I was going to do it, and I bought everything I needed, and I read golf magazines, you know, and I had my own tee time, and we went around in a little cart, and it was just the same old two drunks I'd always run around with, but I wasn't drinking. And it was just going to be great. We'd go out there and play golf and practice and yadda-da-yadda-da-yadda-da, and one day, you know, it just wasn't quite as much fun as it had been before, and so we went to the clubhouse and had a beer. Then we took a case of beer and put it on the golf cart and went out and so. That lasted for a little while, and then last time I played, with any meaningful playing, we had two golf carts with two cases of beer on it. We got to the fourth hole and never got any further. We stopped there on the fourth hole, and I went up and teed up my ball, and they went up and teed up their ball, and we went back, and we had another beer, and we sat there, and some guys said, "Can we play through?" And we said, "Sure, go ahead." Next thing we knew, we'd sent back for another case of beer, and it got dark. It was dark. And we'd been sitting there all day long drinking beer on that hole, and some guys came out from the clubhouse to get us. "Aren't you guys are going to have to leave? It's dark out here." So that didn't work anymore. I did photography for a while. I did the same thing. I bought everything I could buy. I charged everything I could charge. I had wonderful equipment. And it was a wonderful time. It was just a wonderful thing, I enjoyed taking pictures. I loved it. I was going to be in magazines and all this kind of stuff. I imagined myself moving to wherever the Playboy bunnies are, and doing all this stuff. And it lasted for a while, and then the same thing happened, Same thing happened. I sold all that mess. So I had this little beauty shop. I'd started drinking again, and I was quitting. I'd start, and I'd stop. And in any case, what happened was, the last time that I quit, I went for about a year without drinking anything. And by then, people had begun to say something about my drinking, And I had believed them. I thought I was an alcoholic. I thought I was probably an alcoholic, what I understood an alcoholic to be. And I kept thinking, if I just don't drink, everything's going to be okay, and I'm going to make it. And so I would go for these periods of time without drinking. And here I am, I'm going to go for a year. I didn't know it. And in that year, it started off in about a September, and in January, I lost the beauty shop. Because what I had started doing was this. I had started isolating myself. We use that term now. I never heard it back then, but that's what I was doing, as it turns out. I'd go home in the evenings, and I'd go up to one of our bedrooms and lock myself in. Eventually, I got that bad, and I wouldn't come out. And she'd beat on the door, and what's wrong with you? What are you, crazy or something? And I couldn't come out because I didn't want to be around anybody. And the next day, I'd get up, and I'd go to that little shop, and I'd lock the door, and I wouldn't let any customers in. I didn't want them in there. I painted a little bit in those days. Painting was another thing that I was going to do. I was going to be a great watercolorist, And by then, everybody left me. I'd had some people working in my shop, and they'd all moved on for one reason or another. But I had this long manicure table in there, and I'd put my paintings on there, and I'd paint. I'd be painting my pictures, and people would come to the door, and I just wouldn't look at them, or else I'd just go pull the blinds. I wouldn't let them in. And I played in bands sometimes in those days and on through the rest of my life, I'd take a guitar up there, and I'd sit and I'd play, and I'd be playing, I'd practice, and I'd see them come to the door, and I'd pull those drapes, and I wouldn't let them in. So by January of that year, I lost that shop, because you can't do a beauty shop without people, and I wasn't working out. I lost the shop, and in June, my wife ran away with a truck driver. I always said the reason she did that was because she was looking for the exact opposite of a hairdresser, and so she ran away this truck driver. In July, my mother died, and that was my last hope. Mom is your last hope when you don't have anything else. You can always put a touch on Mom. So my mother died, and by about September of that year, I was really crazy. I wasn't getting better. And what happened? Y'all know what happened if you've been any length of time without drinking and you're a drunk. What happened was it never got better. It never got better at all. It got worse. It got worse and it got worse and it got worse. It got worse because I couldn't live life. I couldn't live life without alcohol. I didn't know that's what it was. I kept thinking I'm going to get better because I'm going to get normal. I'm going to eventually get like all these other people. But I've been drinking most of my life by that time. And it wasn't getting better, it only got worse. And so I woke up one morning in September, and I was going crazy. I was in a panic. I was having some kind of panic. And I was just bam, 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 bam. There was nobody around. I was alone. I couldn't stand being alone. I had told my wife one time, she asked me, "What in the world can we do for you? What can I do for you? How can I help you?" And I said, "Look," I said, "just if you just leave me alone. And if they'd leave me alone, and if she'd leave me alone, and if he'd leave me alone, I'd be okay." And I imagined putting all those falling out pieces back together if I could just get a lawn. And wham, I woke up one morning, by God, I was alone. And that's not what you want to be. So I called her up. I called this girl up. She'd been gone several months by that time. And I said, look, because I needed somebody. I couldn't stand not having anybody. I didn't have anybody. I said, I didn't want her to know how bad I felt, you know. I put on my nonchalance and I said, maybe we could go out to dinner tonight. And she said, that'll be okay. He's out of town. I'll meet you for, I'll go out for dinner with you. And so we did. I couldn't wait. I just hung on to that all day long, going crazy. And we went out to dinner. I couldn't eat anything. I couldn't swallow anything. And all she sat there and talked about was this goofball and his truck and how much fun they were having riding all over the country. And I couldn't stand it. I said, you're not doing me any good. Let's get out of here. Yeah, I imagined she was going to fix me. I don't know what I imagined. And we were on the way. I was going to drop her off at the house. And she said, pull in up here and let's get a beer. I said, what? You know I don't drink. I said, do you know I quit drinking? And she said, I know it. You quit everything. You quit drinking. You quit smoking. You quit this. You quit that. And she named all my sins right there in the car, you know, everything I'd quit doing. And really, I'd quit everything by then, as far as she was concerned. And so she said, you can have one beer. And I said, by God, I can have one beer. I can have one. If he can have one beer, I can have one beer. And we stopped and we bought an 8-pack. Somebody said, was it you that said you never seen an 8-pack or never got to drink an 8-pack, wasn't it? We stopped up there and we got an 8-pack of Little Ponies. And I drank my four out of that 8-pack just as fast as I could get the tops off and as fast as I could pour it in my mouth. And it did exactly the same thing for me it did the first time and the 10th time and the 100th time and every other time. I felt like $8 million. And I said, by God, I don't need you anymore. I don't need anybody. Back on the road again. Back on the road again. And I dropped her off and I was on my way to wherever I was going. And I was planning this big, long drunk again. And I pulled up to a stop sign and I was sitting there and I was thinking all this mess going through my head. My head just going zzz, zzz, zzz. And I'd been a year without drinking anything. I'd made it through New Year's. I'd made it through Christmas. I'd made it through birthdays. I'd made it through all these important, crappy occasions. And here it is, the 12th of September, and I'm drinking for no reason that I can see. And I sat there at that sign, and I knew where it was going to lead because it always did. I always got sick. I always got messed up and screwed up, and I didn't want to do it. And I said, God, please don't let me do this again. Please don't let me do this again. And I went home that night, and I didn't drink anymore that night. And I went to work the next day, and by that weekend, I was really just in the worst depression I'd ever been in my life. But I'd not drunk anything. I called my family doctor, and I went to see him, and he sent me to a shrink. And I went to this shrink, and I told him as much of the truth as I could tell him, as much as I knew. I didn't really, by then, I'm just so covered up with all kind of justifications and rationalizations and screwed up emotions and so forth. I told him what I could. One of the things I told him was that I have this customer, and I've been knowing her since 1966, and she's invited me to an AA meeting. I said, what would you think about that? And he said, well, I don't know. You've got to be a real alcoholic to go to an AA meeting. He said, but you might be able to go to an open meeting. So I went home that afternoon. I called her up. Her name's Louise A. She lives in Memphis, and I've been knowing her since she was about 4 years sober. She'd been telling me a lot about AA and a lot about the program, and she told me all kind of things. And I'd watch her fly off every weekend, going to talk here and going to talk there and so forth. And finally, she'd deigned to invite me to a meeting. It was going to be the Bluff City Convention, 1978, and it was going to be November the 1st. This was early October or late September, whenever it was in there. And so I went home, and I remember I called her up, and I said, Louise, do you think maybe we could get to a meeting before November? And she said, I think so. I think we could go to one. We'll get to one Friday night. And she told me later she'd been waiting for me to say that for years. And I'd like to ask you tonight, wonder why in the world she didn't do that in 1966. If she'd have just invited me to a meeting in 1966, I wouldn't have to go through any of that mess, you know. I'd have 30-some-odd years in this program tonight. But she didn't. And don't tell her I said that either. I went to that meeting, and a lot of people say a lot of people drink again, and a lot of people have a lot of problems when they go to their first meeting. A lot of people don't fit, and a lot of people this, that, and the other. And boy, that was not true with me. This is the truth. That was the first place I ever walked into in my life where I saw people like me and felt like I fit, even if just a little bit at that time. I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything like it. Louise chaired the meeting. She said, "My name's Louise. I'm powerless over alcohol." And I said, "I wonder how she knew that word. I wonder how she knew to say that, because it fit me perfectly. I'd had so much power. I had so much willpower to go this year without drinking, and all of a sudden drank for no reason. And that just seemed to fit me." And we went around the room at a newcomers meeting, and the same thing happened happens at all newcomers meetings. Everybody told a little bit about themselves and their drinking, and they talked about being in jail, and they talked about having wrecks, and they talked about all those things that I talked about all the time anyway. I was used to that, you know. Didn't really mean a whole lot to me. But we got around to this one lady, and I don't know if y'all know Arlie. Y'all know Arlie H. Anyway, his wife's name's Patty. They've got a lot of years in the program now, and Patty was sitting back there, and she started talking. And she started talking about, it had anything to do with drinking as far as I could say. She didn't mention drinking at all. She didn't mention alcohol. She didn't say anything about it. But she talked about me. Boy, it was miraculous. I didn't know how, I never heard grown-ups. You know, I was only 35. I was just a little kid. There she was, a grown-up, I imagined, you know, and I'd never heard grown-ups talk like that before. She talked about the long, lonely shadows at that time of the year, and how she'd go home to her apartment and she'd open the door and it'd just be semi-dark, and she'd feel so lonely and cold, and it was starting to get cold and gray and the sun was going away, and she just felt so bad that time of the year, and how she'd always felt these feelings, you know. And I thought, Jesus, I remember being at my grandmother's house when I was 5 years old, looking out the window and feeling like that. That same old soul sickness, somebody said. Kevin said that. That's what it is. That's what my sponsor calls it. Sort of a soul sickness. And I related to that. I identified with what she was talking about. And that's why I wanted to go back to another meeting. I wanted to hear more of that. I didn't know what it had to do with drinking, but I knew what it had to do with me. And so I started going to meetings, and I just loved it. I'd leave work, go to meetings in the middle of the day. I'd go to marathon meetings on the weekends that they're all night long. I just soaked it up, ate it up, chewed it up, and I couldn't get enough of it. I still didn't know what it had to do with me and drinking. And really, it was a number of years before I understood really what that was. I didn't believe it was a disease for a long time because I couldn't see what it was. I couldn't feel it, and I couldn't get a good description of it in my mind. I couldn't get it fit in my mind. And some people come here and say, well, it didn't make any difference to me if it was or not, but it made a difference to me because it seemed to be my life. You all had this disease of alcoholism, and I couldn't figure out what it was. All I did was just drink and quit, drink and quit, drink and quit. And in the meantime, I had all these crappy feelings. But what'd that have to do with it, you know? I'd go to meetings, and these old-timers would say, well, I'd say, what is this alcoholism? And they'd say, it's your underlying problem. And I'd say, what's my underlying problem? They'd say, alcoholism. I'd say, well, hell, what? I don't understand. By the time I was 5 years sober, got married again and gone down the tubes again. I hadn't gotten drunk, but I'd gotten crazy. Had to come back up again, start working some steps, and somehow or other, I listened to some tapes and I heard some people describe this thing, and one time I heard a man say it perfectly. He just told me exactly what it was. He told me what alcoholism was, and it was what I had. It was me. It was the story of my life. It was all that mess that I'd grown up with, and it was the fact that I could take one, two drinks of alcohol and wham! Fix me right there on the spot. Fixed right on the spot. Make any difference how bad I got, how rotten I got, how lonely I got, how shy I got, how introverted I got, how crazy I got. Take a couple of drinks and smooth city. Smooth city. And you know there's like 95% of the population of the world that don't get that when they drink alcohol. I didn't know that either. I thought everybody got that out of alcohol, and I couldn't understand why everybody didn't drink. I thought maybe they just had more willpower than I did. And all of a sudden I realized I'm part of this magic 5% that has this alcoholism, whatever it is. Sensitivity to alcohol, I guess. Alcohol fixes these problems. Other people have problems. Other people have those same things. And alcohol doesn't do anything for them, unfortunately. That's too bad. I guess maybe they're just neurotics or something. I don't know. But any of us that have that soul sickness, that deep problem, that whatever, you just automatically know that you can go back to that drink and it's okay. It's okay. I haven't had a drink in some time now. And rotten things have happened, and good things have happened, and people have died, and holidays have come and gone, and I fixed hair for 30 years and decided I was tired of it and quit, and listened for that voice of God to tell me what to do next, and probably did the wrong thing. I don't know. I did that for a year, and then I did something else for almost a year, and now I'm doing something else and just sort of bouncing around, and things seem to be a little nutty in my life right now. Seems to be just a little crazy. Seem to be bouncing from this to this to this to this to whatever, you know, looking for some niche, I guess. I don't know. I know that we moved over to Little Rock for a time, and I enjoyed what I was doing very much. Didn't seem I could get along with the people. Quit, came back, did something else. I worked in a casino for a time, you know, and that was gonna be it. But I realized that wasn't really it. That was just what I was gonna do until I found something really to do, you know. And so now I've gone to work for another corporation that, in sales, and I don't know if that's it or not. I like what I'm doing. If I can get it going, But there's one thing through all of these things. Through all these times and all of these things and all this crap and all this mess, all the great times when I would have got drunk, all the crappy times when I would have got drunk, and that is that I hadn't gotten drunk. I hadn't had a drink. I hadn't had a drink since I had my last drink on September the 12th of 1978. And I'll tell you what, I'm very, very grateful for that. I'm never, ever, ever grateful enough for it. I don't know that I ever realized how grateful I could be for it until I quit my last job. You know? And there it was. There was Alcoholics Anonymous. There was my friends. I've got friends in this room. Some of them I've known for years and years. Some I've known for a short time. They're very good friends of mine. I've got those people. I never would have had them without Alcoholics Anonymous. Never would have known about it. People in this room that I've known for a long, long time. Maybe not know them real well, but I've known of them. And there they all are. Made new friends this weekend. I've got a home group, which is the Greenbrook Group in South Haven, Mississippi. I love my group. I love the people that come there. I don't know what I'd do without it. I still know today that there are two ways that I can treat my alcoholism. And they both work. One of them is to take a drink and another drink. And it fixes that craziness within me. But then I'm gone. And the other one is to do what's in this book and to do what I've learned in AA. And that seems to work and keeps me reasonably normal. And all I have to do is just talk to Louise every once in a while. I don't want to do any talking. She does the talking. You know that. Talk to her every once in a while. I go to meetings regularly. I read my book. I get on my knees and I talk to my higher power, which fortunately I discovered very early in this program because I've needed him all the way through it. I talk to friends in the program and do whatever I'm asked to do. I go to my home group, do whatever it takes. And I believe that's what keeps me sober. My higher power keeps me sober, along with these other things. And I'd much rather do that than the other. I guarantee you, I'd much rather do that than the other. I've gotten married again. Gail and I have been married for 10 years. And I believe we've had a grand time together, a really grand time together. We've been a lot of places and done a lot of things. And she was once the Al-Anon state delegate in Tennessee. And I was so proud of her. I was so proud. She said, how's it going to feel traveling around on my coattails? I said, all my life I've wanted a woman with coattails. We had a great time going and coming and doing things, and still we do. Still we do. I love her, and I can't imagine me being with anybody else today. So whatever happens, it's going to be up. It's going to be up, and it's going to work for me because of this program. And in any case, if I do the same thing tomorrow that I did today, I won't be drunk. I'll be here with y'all, and we'll have a great weekend together. And I sure appreciate Milton. Did Milton ever get here? No? Okay. I appreciate very, very much y'all having me here this weekend. Thanks a lot for listening. Good night.